Okay, let's get started. Hey guys, I'm sorry we're having sort of multiple technical difficulties, but let's think through a case. We'll do this without PowerPoint. This happened in the unit. Actually, Brenda, Dr. Chenard just reminded me of a case we had just 2 weeks ago in the ICU. There's probably a few of you here that know this patient. And I think it's worth thinking this through a little bit. At least we can sort of talk through some principles of pathophysiology and something that will happen to you guys occasionally in the future, but it's kind of worth thinking about, really, in a number of patients that you see. We had a patient admitted to us about 3 weeks ago who had a history of alcoholic cirrhosis. She was in her mid-50s, pretty bright lady, and was generally doing fairly well. She had fairly well-preserved liver synthetic function with no previous episodes of portosystemic encephalopathy and an INR that was only slightly elevated. But she had some symptoms of portal hypertension and it had esophageal varices. And in fact, this time when she came into the hospital, she came in with an upper GI bleed. And she was seen by GI initially and was banded for her esophageal varices, and they thought that they had a successful banding of her varices. But one complication regarding her care was that she had a personal belief against getting blood transfusions. She wasn't a Jehovah's Witness, although her daughter was, but she had had a personal friend that died from an infection that she got of West Nile virus related to transfusion. And she had just decided over the course of her life that she never wanted to be transfused, even if it meant her death. And this was not a new thing that she just thought of that day. It had been discussed in the past with her husband, and he was pretty aware of it and argued with her about it. In fact, she said that she wanted her daughter to be her medical power of attorney, specifically because she knew that her husband disagreed with her on this point. And so that was what we were sort of presented with. And at the time we first saw her, after her banding, her hemoglobin was 7.6. And so let me throw out to you guys how you would manage this from, you know, we should probably talk about a couple different issues, and those would include, first of all, ethical issues, legal issues, and then let's talk about the medicine. Did you guys have any thoughts about it from an ethical standpoint or a legal standpoint? You know, now I've turned my ringer off. Hello, this is Dr. Rashke. Is this an emergency? Hey, Alan, I'm sorry, I'm giving a lecture to the... Yeah, hi. It's Alan Leibowitz. Okay, Alan? Yes, hello. Yes. Thank you so much for calling. Okay, bye-bye. Can't turn away a call from Dr. Leibowitz. Maybe there's no ethical issues here, huh? Is everyone comfortable with that? I don't know. I mean, I still troubled me a little bit, but I kind of put that aside fairly quickly. She seemed pretty rational. She wasn't encephalopathic. It wasn't some brand new idea she had. I'm not sure I really shared her belief, and I had a little trouble understanding it, but I guess that's okay. We don't always have to understand what our patients want. I'll tell you later, maybe towards the end, we should come back to it and readdress it, because actually, one thing to think about, and we're going to increasingly be asked to think about in the future, is the social justice of doing this, because as you'll see, what happened in her care is that her care probably turned out to be extremely expensive, and probably a couple units of blood might have saved tens of thousands of dollars of medical care that was done in an effort to sort of get around giving her the blood. But that's what she requested, and in 2013, I think that's what we should do and what we did. She did tell me. She said, I really want to live. She said, I don't want to be like a DNR or something. I enjoy life. She said, please try whatever you can do to help me survive through this.
I guess the question is, how informed was she?
It's so rare. Yeah. Yeah, you know, maybe we should have. You know, maybe in retrospect, originally, we should have spent more time. She had already been talked to by multiple people before she got to me, and I just sort of confirmed what she thought. I didn't really try too hard to argue with her about it, but I sort of took the approach I've take with Jehovah's Witness patients, which is I don't argue with them. I just confirm what they want, and I just want to respect what they believe in. But maybe in her case, we should have sort of questioned that more. And I think in retrospect now, too, that should be addressed in the future because this may come up again. I think she might still be here in the hospital. Yeah. It's probably something worth talking to her about again. What would you guys do, though? Could people just give me one thing each to do? And let's sort of talk through what we can do here as blood conservation. Okay, how would you do that? We found it very hard to not do blood draws on her. And the first day, even though we said we weren't gonna, everything got done because the nurse thought we just forgot to order it. So even though we canceled all the orders for the routine stuff, they did everything the next morning. We had to say, no, it was on purpose. We didn't order any of that stuff. We sort of played with it a little over a couple days, and one thing we found that worked pretty good was, you know, following things you can't do anything about probably is very attractive, but isn't really helpful. Like knowing the H&H or the CBC very frequently isn't help you if you can't do anything to give the blood back. And one thing we did was we did put an A-line in her, and for some other reasons I'll tell you about, but we were doing just a blood gas and then doing I-STAT labs on her. And for one period, we were just doing them every other day, and then we were doing them every day. So the blood gas is just like a cc or two of blood once a day or once every other day. That seemed pretty good. What else could you do? Yes, thank you. And somewhat strangely, she was okay with getting other blood products. It was only packed red blood cells she wouldn't take. And you guys know, typically, Jehovah's Witness patients won't take fresh frozen plasma, platelets, or blood. But they may take other products derived from blood, things like albumin. Sometimes they're okay with, and you sort of have to talk that through with them. But she was okay with getting FFP and platelets, which we gave her. And we also gave her some DDAVP to help repair her platelet function as it would be affected by her liver failure. So we tried to sort of fix the coagulopathy, fix the thrombocytopenia, and fix the abnormal platelet function as best that we could. And then we had pretty good source control already because we had the banding. So source control would be another thing to think about. What else? Yeah, there's a tricky one and a difficult one to think about. And any procedure that might cause bleeding would have to be considered very carefully. She, along the course of her illness, she developed pretty bad effusions, and she had a pleural effusion and bad ascites, and we really tried to shy away from putting needles in her. And you guys know that tips are fairly safe, but there have been some cases here of rupture of the liver, hepatic bleeding related to tips. So I think if she had bled again, tips would have been definitely something to think about, but so long as she wasn't bleeding, we were afraid to poke any needles in her belly that were not entirely necessary, but it was hard. People wanted to do a paracentesis on her so bad because her belly was big, but it wasn't tight. It wasn't causing abdominal compartment syndrome or anything like that. We didn't think her belly was infected. So we tried to stay away from any procedures on her, even though you kind of wanted to do a few. We gave her erythropoietin. I was really interested in this, Dimitri, because I thought, we've looked at it in the past, I think the dose that you give is really variable. I think it might be cheaper now than it used to be, because pharmacy used to give us a hard time. about the dosing on it, and they were really helpful this time, just saying give a lot. They're not good RCTs to say how much to give, but we were given 20,000 units every day, which seemed like about the most that anyone really had been given in the literature. And they say erythropoietin takes 7 to 10 days, but her hemoglobin started coming up much sooner than that. And I think by about the 4th or 5th day, she was trending up. What sort of happened, I want to come back to this discussion because there's probably a couple other things to talk about. But what sort of happened over the course of this was her hemoglobin went from 7.6 to 5 to 3.3. And at the point that she was at 3.3, her heart rate was 140. Her anion gap and lactate levels went up. Her troponin was 10. And she looked really bad. She looked like she wasn't going to survive. But let me come back to, I just want to sort of paint the clinical picture, you guys, as we're thinking this through. Because at 7 point whatever, she's just sitting there. But by the time she equilibrated, she was actually... She looked like she might die from euvolemic anemia, which is something that you don't see very often, actually. So stop the bleeding, source control, reverse coagulopathy, erythropoietin, reduce phlebotomy as to minimal possible. What else? The bone marrow needs more than just erythropoietin. Good. So a couple good things there. We need to give iron. And as best I can tell, the fastest way, does anyone know probably the fastest way to give iron? Do you know, probably you guys all know this, but I'll just review this briefly with you. You know that iron is really toxic. Actually, and in an overdose, the iron overdose is highly fatal. And on the toxicology service, sometimes they'll have cases of people that take an overdose of vitamins, you know, which doesn't seem to me like a patient would understand that that could be fatal. But if they're vitamins with iron, the iron content of the vitamins could actually be fatal. And so your body has a limit on how much iron it can absorb before it starts to have systemic effects that are very dangerous. So we're kind of limited how fast we can give iron. And there's a number of different products to give it intravenously, like iron dextran and iron sucrose. And iron dextran, people sometimes have allergies to. But iron sucrose, even without an allergy, the amount you can give is limited. And you guys should know, and have you guys done this before with patients that are Jehovah's Witness? You can actually calculate. There's these nice calculators online where you can go online. You don't have to go online if you don't want to. You can just do it yourself too. But you can actually calculate by the patient's size and weight and their hemoglobin what their iron deficit is. And then you could replace their iron deficit as iron sucrose. The limit's about 500 milligrams a day. And in a typical patient who's a Jehovah's Witness who has a hemoglobin of 3 or 4, you're going to be looking at it probably a 2 to 3 gram iron deficit. So it's going to take you 4 to 6 days to get that into them. And when they've tried to give iron sucrose faster than that, the patients have systemic illness related to the iron toxicity. So they say probably 500 milligrams a day is the most that you can give, as fast as you can give it. These are just really based on case reports. Iron, and then vitamins to support hematopoiesis, so B12 and folate could be given. And the folate would be like 1 milligram a day. And then the B12, you could just give one dose of 1,000 micrograms of B12. So all that's done, and her hemoglobin is still 3.3, and her lactate is 10, and her troponin is 10, and her heart rate's 145. Any other ideas? Yeah, so you guys are probably aware, and I don't have a marker, but think in your minds, oh, I do have a marker. A lot of what we do in critical care is related to this equation
which has to do with oxygen delivery. And the oxygen delivery to the body is related to cardiac output times the oxygen carrying capacity of blood, which has a constant in it, the amount of hemoglobin you have, your oxygen saturation, and it has a number here related to how much oxygen is dissolved in your blood, which you can see is small. So a lot of what we do in critical care has to do with supporting people's cardiac output, giving them blood if they need it, intubating them and putting them on a ventilator so their oxygen saturation is good. And if you can control these three things, you can control the oxygen delivery that the heart has, so you could potentially prevent shock, which is a failure of the ability of the body to provide oxygen and nutrients to the tissues. But in this case, we have a problem that we can't. Now our hemoglobin's gone from 15 to 3, so we've lost 80% of our oxygen carrying capacity in our blood, and there's no way that cardiac output or our oxygen saturation can compensate for that, right? I mean, our oxygen compensation was already close to 100%. Our cardiac output maybe could double, but she is doubled and tripled now. Her heart rate is 140, but obviously her heart is the part of her body that's gonna die from euvolemic anemia, because her heart is the part of her body that's using the most oxygen. So it's hard for your heart to compensate for really severe anemia like that for very long before it becomes fatal. But maybe when all efforts to improve oxygen delivery have failed, maybe you can reduce oxygen consumption. And so I think that was a good idea that you had, and we tried it. We've tried this a time or two before in patients that are Jehovah's Witnesses, and so far, to my memory, it had been unsuccessful in the past, partly because the bleeding continued with other patients that we tried this before. But we did intubate her, we sedated her and paralyzed her, we put her on an esmolol infusion, we got her heart rate down to about 60, and got her real calm, and she, her lactate level came down, her troponin came down, and she kind of just went into a resting state then for a number of days. We thought about doing hypothermia on her, but we held off. We were kind of worried. Hypothermia could be used to reduce oxygen consumption, but it actually can sometimes cause increasing bleeding too. So we decided to hold that in her back pocket in case things got worse. And her hemoglobin nadired at 3.3. And then we just waited. We kind of went without labs for a few days. And then I think by the third day, she was 3.4. And then the next day, she was like 5.1. And she actually came up quicker than we thought with the iron sucrose and the EPO. And then she went out to the floor. And you guys probably know better now. It's been a while since I've seen her. But she seemed like she's kind of doing okay. It might be worth at this point talking through with her again, sort of her and her husband, sort of the social justice of doing that. Are we really going to do this every time that she bleeds? Because she's probably going to have more bleeding episodes. Yeah, and if she's going to, especially if she's going to still keep drinking, I don't know. Really, it's sort of disquieting, isn't it, to think that we would do this every time for her? No, you know, before we went into it, we tried to be sure we weren't going to get into a dilemma with him. But the patient was, she actually was pretty smart about what she wanted. I mean, she said, I want my daughter to be my medical power of attorney. And her daughter supported what she did. And her husband said, I'm against what she's doing, but this is what she wants. I don't know, maybe we should have, I don't know, I mean, I think definitely now it should be talked about now that it's a little bit less immediately life-threatening. Well, I don't know that was her greatest concern. She had a hard time sort of expressing it. She told us she thought blood was sacred, and she, you know, I think the infection thing wasn't a huge thing.
Of note, I think the last and probably only, I mean, I wanted to ask her more about this because the only patient I know of, actually, you know, the SAFIS service here published a case of West Nile, transfusion-related West Nile here a few years back in MMWR, and at the time it was the first case in the country, like in the last 5 years. So it's extremely rare. And actually, since that case, they've changed the way they screen the blood to make it even more unlikely that West Nile would be transmitted by a blood transfusion. So weirdly, the SAFIS, the academic service here, actually has a little role that they've played in that relation to West transfusion-related West Nile. But I don't know, that was their case. I thought it was sort of interesting physiology. The ethics of it remain a little bit questionable. We used to have a very good blood conservation specialist here at the hospital, but he left the hospital a couple years ago. So you guys will be a little bit more on your own now when you have a patient who will more likely be a Jehovah's Witness that is a bleeding patient. But those are some options that you have to think through to treat them. Strangely, in my mind, I think it's pretty strange that we don't have good hemoglobin replacement molecules that are available. They've been studied for a long time. The FDA took the current one that was available off the market here, and they won't license the company that manufactures it to release it for clinical use. You'd think that's something that the military would really be pushing for, and maybe they are, but last time I checked, we don't have availability of any artificial hemoglobin molecule. I don't know about the other places. I know the guy who used to be in charge of our blood conservation project here, program, was a Jehovah's Witness. So it was great to have him come help with these things. But I think a lot of the principles of the care still survive. And all the things I told you about were stuff that we kind of worked through with him while he was here. But I don't know what they have at other hospitals, to be honest with you. I think we could match it pretty well, though, here, so long as you kind of think it through. But we're trying to get an order set so that you guys don't have to reinvent it every time it happens, because it's kind of infrequent. And even for us in the unit, we had to sort of pull a lot of papers again that I probably pulled 2 years ago, pull them out again and try to remember how to do all this. But we're working on an order set. So, Ben, did you have a last comment? No one said a thing, but I think we're in a grace period where we're still flying beneath their radar, but I think it's going to change with the ACOs. This is going to be everyone's concern then, because it's going to be a loss. You know, and right now, under our current system, I don't really know her insurance, but under the current system, that could have made money for the hospital, even though it would cost her insurance company money. Under the new system, that's going to lose a lot of money for our ACO to do that. So I suspect in the future we're going to have a lot more scrutiny of that, and probably won't only be just our decision and the patient's decision to do whatever the patient wants, even if it's sort of, I mean, it really is pretty unreasonable when you think of it, especially if she's going to keep drinking and want us to do this repeatedly. It probably really isn't reasonable for her to be able to have us all pay for that. But we'll have to work that through. All right. Thanks, you guys.